This podcast is not intended as a substitute for proper diagnosis and medical care by a qualified veterinarian. Furthermore, the views expressed in this podcast are those of our hospital only and are not intended to represent the policies and practices of other animal hospitals. Welcome to the Animal Hospital of North Asheville podcast. I'm your host, Gretchen Harwell, and joining me today for his fourth interview is Dr. Scott Lovelace. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Lovelace.
You're welcome.
And today we're going to talk about Addison's disease, which is fairly uncommon. It's not something we see every day, but let me start with an easy question. Is this something we see in cats and dogs?
We do see it in cats and dogs, but the majority of cases are dogs. In cats, it's an extremely rare disease. I mean, it's very unusual to see it in cats. Even for dogs, it's still a pretty unusual disease.
Okay. And next question is, what is Addison's disease?
Addison's disease is also known as hypoadrenocorticism. And it's basically, if you look at the word, it means hypo, which is low, adrenocorticism, which basically means functioning of the adrenal gland. So it's basically low or no functioning of the adrenal gland is what it basically boils down to.
Okay, and where are the adrenal glands in the body and what purpose do they serve?
All right, the adrenal glands are located very close to the kidneys. They're usually right above the kidneys. They're little peanut-shaped organs, and their basic purpose in our talk today will be two main functions. They do have a little bit more purposes or a little bit more functions, but we're not going to go into all that today. The main purpose is to produce corticosteroids, which are like cortisol, which is basically most people talk about, like prednisone is very similar to cortisol. And the other function they have is to provide mineralocorticoids, which help to control electrolyte function and kidney function in the body.
Okay, and you sort of already answered what these hormones do in the body. So with that in mind, when a patient has Addison's disease, what bodily processes are compromised?
For the majority of the cases, what they have is problems with their sodium-potassium balance and their water, what we call water homeostasis, basically the balance of water in their body. The sodium is normally something your body wants to conserve. Everybody knows that you need salt to live. It's one of those things that's a big function in the body. It has lots of different, from anything from muscles to heart to all sorts of functions in the body. One of the things the mineralocorticoids do is to help preserve the basic conservation of sodium in the body. The other thing, so basically when they stop functioning, you lose sodium and your sodium levels go down. Mm-hmm. The other big thing is the potassium. And the potassium, in this case, these corticoids help the potassium to leave the body and not to get an overabundance. And the problem with is if your potassium builds up in your system, it can cause problems as well with the heart. And basically just makes you just don't feel good in the case with that. It can also, both these balance and the water balance can affect your filtration rate in your kidneys and can make your kidney function decrease, much like if you had kidney failure, you'd see similar signs to that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I remember way back in my anatomy and physiology classes, they talked about the sodium potassium pump, which is how our muscles fire and contract. So that probably has something to do with why it affects, like, the way the heart pumps and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Muscle function, when they're out of balance, you can feel fatigued. And
right.
Say everything's just not working like it's supposed
right,
to.
Right, because they can't fire the way they should. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And what symptoms might a client notice at home with their pet?
Yeah, this is a tricky answer. The problem with this is there's a lot of symptoms, and most of them are kind of vague. Addison's is known as the great imitator, which means it can look like a lot of different things. It can look like gastroenteritis, it can look like kidney failure, it can look like just a variety of diseases. It's not really one specific thing that it has. Common things we see, weakness, a lot of times GI issues, diarrhea, nausea, And then sometimes it has very waxing and waning illnesses. So it'll get bad and then it'll get better all of a sudden, and then it'll get bad again. And you see this, you know, this waxing and waning continues until they get into what we call an Addisonian crisis,
mm-hmm.
Which we'll talk about in a minute.
Okay. And how do you go about diagnosing Addison's disease? Is it pretty simple, or is it a process of elimination? Because you mentioned it's known as the great imitator. So do you have to take away all those other things that it might be first? Or
Yeah. It's kind of complex because on the blood work, there's not a whole lot of consistency. It can look like kidney failure very oftentimes. Mm-hmm. It could be a middle-aged dog or young dog that looks like they have kidney failure, but they don't. They have Addison's going on. One of the biggest things we can sometimes see, or hopefully most of the time see, is an imbalance in the sodium and potassium ratios. And this is basically a number where we take the value you get for the sodium in the body, and we take the value you get for the potassium, and we basically divide the sodium by the potassium, and you get a number. Mm-hmm. If that number is, 28 or less, then it makes you suspicious for Addison's disease. Unfortunately, that's not the only thing that can cause that to go down. There are other things that can cause that number to be off. There can be what's called third space loss. There can be whipworms can cause that. It's a parasite.
Mm-hmm.
So in some dogs, that's not the case. So it's usually, the concurrence of clinical signs and symptoms along with this. They can look like they have kidney failure. Some do, some don't. One tricky thing, we had a dog one time that was just shaking for several weeks. That was the only thing it did, was shake a little bit. And, we couldn't tell what was wrong with it. And when we looked at it, it would look pretty good. And some dogs come in, just kind of down and out and just not feeling good.
Yeah, so that sounds very, very vague, basically.
Yes.
And I guess probably as a little bit of a tangent, if you had a puppy with that low sodium-potassium ratio, your first guess wouldn't be Addison's. Your first guess would be whipworms.
Correct.
Because puppies get whipworms, and it's less common in adult dogs.
Correct. So, yeah, puppies, if they have a sodium potassium off, it doesn't make me think Addison's right away. Whipworms more common. And that being said, we have actually had a puppy, I think, last year or a couple years ago it was a young dog. It ended up having Addison's.
Right.
We ruled out everything else, and he came in an Addisonian crisis. And usually whipworms are going to make him feel bad, but not this bad.
Right.
So that's what sometimes can help to tell the difference.
Right.
And then once you get that low sodium potassium ratio and everything else is making you suspicious, you still don't know 100% for sure. So you need to run a more specific test. And there is a test for that. We call it an ACTH stim.
Mm-hmm.
And what that involves is we measure the baseline cortisol level. We give them an injection of what's called ACTH. And it's basically a hormone that should make the adrenal gland produce more cortisol in the bloodstream. And then once they have that and you give them the injection, and we measure the blood work again an hour later. And in a normal dog, that you should have a baseline cortisol and it should go up at the end of that hour. Usually with an Addisonian, you're going to have a low or subnormal to start out with. And when you give them the ACTH, you're not going to see any response. Because their adrenal gland is not able to respond to that hormone like it should. So you usually get a low value and another low value. And that's usually when we get both of those, we're usually pretty convinced they have Addison's disease.
Okay. And now you've mentioned the Addisonian crisis. What does that look like?
Yeah. And that's really usually they're in a bad situation. A lot of dogs do. That's the way they present like that. They present when they're in the crisis at the time. And what it is they're usually, showing a lot of these signs we talked about before. There's a lot of muscle weakness.
Mm-hmm.
They're just feeling lethargic. They're usually can be kind of skinny for some reason. They're usually sometimes having some GI symptoms, and they can vary. We had one, I think, last week that came in, a big Great Pyrenees, had just been having some GI issues, not eating well, had, I think, urinated on the owner's bed, and just acting lethargic in general.
Right.
And it's just kind of one of those things that's not really very nonspecific, and then, we were clued in when we did some blood work on it to see what was going on.
Right. Okay. And just kind of out of curiosity, how prevalent is Addison's disease in the general pet population? Like, how frequently do we see a new Addison's case?
Right. So they're not very common. And this is usually dogs we're talking about. Cats are even more rare than this.
Right.
But usually I was reading some statistics that basically said that, for every two vets in a practice, they should diagnose you know, probably the chances are about one Addison's case a year between for every two vets in a clinic. So it's an incidence of, I think, like 0.5 per 1,000 sick patients is kind of what they're going on. So it's not very common. And usually, like I said, when they present, it's when they're in the Addisonian crisis and we're feeling really bad. Now, sometimes we can catch them before that, but like I said, it's usually, unless we're doing blood work for that, because a lot of times the cases wax and wane, so it's a lot of times they get better, and then the owners say, oh, you know, we're feeling better now.
Right.
So it's one of those things that don't always get sought out for attention, because the signs can be kind of mild until they get
critically ill. Right. Well, and I guess, you know, it kind of makes sense, because if my dog feels a little puny for a few days, you know, I might not tie it together until it's happened, you know, let's say four times in a row. Like, oh, this is the same as it's been. Maybe there's a bigger picture. It's not just, oh, you know, he ate something bad.
Right.
Right. So it, you know, it kind of makes sense that people, you may not notice it until they're at a crisis point, because exactly. It's so vague that you just don't, you know, it doesn't even cross anybody's mind sometimes.
Exactly. And it can be, you know, and at the crisis, it can be life-threatening. I mean, they have low blood pressure, their potassium is high, their sodium is low, they're usually dehydrated at the time because they can't, their renal functions aren't normal. And so, like I said, when you get the basic blood work, it does a lot of times look like they're in kidney failure as well.
Right.
And they're like we talked about earlier.
Yes, okay. And now you mentioned one breed of dog that you saw with it. Is there like a list of classic breeds that like, oh, you know, it's a beagle and this happened. It's got to be Addison's. Is there a list of breeds where it's like, you know, these breeds, you know, it's more common in these breeds?
There is. Though on the top of the list is mixed. On the top of the list of is mixed. It says mixed breed is the top of the list. So, but a lot of times, like I said, this last one is a Great Pyrenees and it wasn't on the list. So I would say it doesn't always follow the list. So I'll give you a list, but a list is just that. It's just a list of things they found more common, but as an uncommon disease, it doesn't necessarily always follow this list.
Right.
So on the list involve toy poodles, miniature poodles, standard poodles, Labradors, Rottweilers, German Shepherds, Dobermans, Golden Retrievers, West Highland White Terriers, Great Danes. I think Bearded Collie is at an increased risk, but they don't. There aren't as many of those, so we don't see as many.
Right.
And I think Bassets are also increased risk, and for the same reason we don't see as many of those, so I don't think of them as much.
Right. Well, and I mean, from that list, honestly, the first dog I can think of our patients that have Addison's is a mixed breed dog.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there it is.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, that's a pretty diverse list. It's not like it's like, oh, all the sight hounds.
Right.
That's a list.
Exactly. And then, you know, there's also being female does put dogs at a higher risk.
Really?
And it usually happens in young to middle-aged dogs.
Okay.
I think I found a statistic that basically said that 76% of them are less than 7 years of age when they're diagnosed with it. So it's majority not in older dogs, but in young to middle-aged dogs. I think we've had one maybe, I think, 6 or 7 months old. They can be as older than that as well, but this is just the statistics.
Right. Okay. And then how do we treat it? Once we have a diagnosis, we've done that stim test, you know, everything's lining up. What's the next step?
Right. So usually, like I said, we do diagnose a lot of times when they're in the Addisonian crisis. So I'll start with that. If we're not in the crisis mode, the treatment's a little bit simpler. We just kind of skip a lot of these initial steps and go right to the other steps we'll talk about. But the initial steps, we want to basically correct their renal function. I mean, we're hypotensive, maybe it's low blood pressure, we need to give IV fluids, basically treat for shock. All these dogs will come in shocky, they'll come in basically in shock, and we need to give them IV fluids. Usually we want to give them saline, which is not our necessarily normal fluid choice. The saline doesn't have any potassium in it. In this case, we want to get all the potassium out of the body, and the fluids help to flush it out of the body, help the kidneys to get rid of it. We also want to, as soon as we have a diagnosis, to help with vascular integrity and just make them feel better. A lot of times we want to give them a steroid to kind of help with that. And a lot of times there's different ways. We have IV intravenous steroids we can use in the beginning a lot of times just to get it in there faster. And then the other thing we need to do is correct their electrolyte imbalance. So in the future, they can, they don't have the kidney failure. They can get rid of their excessive potassium. They can hold on to their sodium they need. And usually that's an injection. Usually what we start out with an injection, we'll just do the shortened name, DOCP. There are two name brands of that out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's Zycortal and Percortin.
Right.
Like I said, those are two of the name brands for that particular thing, but DOCP is the injection, and that's the mineralocorticoids. That's going to help with the fluid balance in the body, and then we also give it, like I said, that, and then we also give the steroid, and those are the two main functions that we can correct in the body with that. We can also, sometimes if they're have acidosis or they have hypoglycemia, we can also correct that in the fluids and give them medications for that as well, but that's more of a case-by-case basis.
Right. And then, so once we have addressed the crisis and then we have them sort of back to a baseline, mm-hmm. What's our prognosis? Is this like, I mean, clearly it sounds like it's a lifelong thing, but how long is that life?
Right. So usually their life expectancy is pretty much normal as long as they receive treatment. And, you know, the crisis is their biggest thing, is we just got to keep them out of the crisis and keep their function of their kidneys normal. Mm-hmm. We also have to keep them with steroids and things like that to keep them functioning on a day-to-day basis. So their average life expectancy is about the same as it would be otherwise. They say, I think, about 7 years, after which, for a lot of dogs, if you get it middle age, 4 or 5, they put them at 10, 11, 12, mm-hmm. depending on when they get it. So, like I said, it should be, you know, relatively normal life expectancy as long as you keep the medication, keep them under control and keep monitoring them. And it does require frequent monitoring of the condition until you get them in the normal state. Like I said, once times you get them in a kind of a pattern, a lot of doctors feel comfortable just saying, you know, you can recheck just kind of as they need to, or they'll give you, the veterinarian in charge will tell you, okay, we need to recheck them every so often, months. But it can take a while just to get them, to figure out how often you need to give them either the shot and then what the dose of steroids is going to be, and that can vary. But
right.
Like I said, once you get it stable, it's usually pretty.
Right. Hopefully there's not too much tinkering with the doses and that kind of stuff. Once you get to a point, best case scenario, you can kind of coast a little bit with that regimen. You know, obviously you don't want to just stop because they feel better.
Right.
And that's the tendency, I think, a lot of times. It's the same thing when people and pets, you know, we're giving antibiotics. It's like, well, I feel better. I felt better, so I stopped.
Right. So this is something, if you stop, you're going to go right back into Addisonian crisis mode. And so we want to keep giving it. Sometimes we'll do monitoring like electrolytes and things like that, mm-hmm. to figure out how often we need to give the mineralocorticoid mm-hmm. injection. Because like I said, it can vary. I think it varies from 21 to 30 days. And sometimes we'll try to, with bigger dogs, because it's costly. That's the biggest downside of that injection, is it does, it's kind of expensive injection. And so sometimes we'll try to, you know, decrease the dose as low as we can. We have to monitor that and make sure that we're not decreasing it too much to send us right back into the Addisonian crisis and the kidney failure, or what looks like kidney failure,
right,
to the dog.
Right. Okay. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about, or any good tidbits to share?
So there's a couple things I had when looking this over at my notes and everything. One was John F. Kennedy apparently had Addison's disease. And one of my other doctors in the clinic let me know that.
Pretty cool.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing I always talk about is I'm always, you know, why is it called Addison's disease? Why not a hypoadrenocorticism? First, it's kind of hard to say, and saying it a long time very frequently will kind of get your tongue twisted. But this one actually was noted by a guy named Thomas Addison, who described the clinical syndromes in humans. And he had the description of, and I'll read you the description that he had, For what he described the disease as. They had anemia, general languor, debility, remarkable feebleness of the heart's action, and irritability of the stomach. And they said that when they did autopsies of these guys, they either had tuberculosis obstruction or atrophy of the adrenal glands. So this was back in the 1855 or 1850s that he described this, so I think tuberculosis was still a lot bigger deal than it is today. And so something basically destroyed the adrenal glands, and they found that this was all post-mortem, so they didn't have any treatment. So pretty much if you got this disease, back in the 1800s, you died.
Right. So. Well, and thank goodness that we're past that phase of medicine.
Yes.
And this is clearly, I mean, I'm guessing he didn't name it after himself. He was just the first one
right.
to describe it. So
exactly.
And I think also, to a certain extent, we're sort of past naming things after people anymore. Like, we look at surgical procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, the doctor who developed, like, the TPLO, the orthopedic procedure,
right.
is a guy named Dr. Slocum. But mm-hmm. we don't call it the Slocum.
Nope.
So, but Thomas Addison was lucky. He was still in that window where we named things after people.
That's
so,
right.
All right. Well, go ahead.
And the other thing I was going to mention that we do have, that sometimes, this is kind of rare, that, you know, we talked about the common causes are idiopathic. We don't really know the main causes, but in some cases, this disease is kind of what I consider the opposite of another disease we're going to be talking about shortly, Cushing's mm-hmm. disease.
Right.
Cushing's disease is hyperadrenocorticism, so it's basically overproduction of all these hormones we just talked about, mainly cortisol. The interesting thing is sometimes when we're treating hyperadrenocorticism or Cushing's disease, we can cause, with the medications for that, we can actually cause an Addisonian crisis or cause them to be Addisonian, because in that case, we're trying to suppress the adrenal gland. And if we give too much, we're going to suppress it too much, and we're going to cause Addison's disease. The other thing, you've probably heard that, you know, when you're taking steroids, you always have to taper down off of steroids.
Right.
One of the reasons is you can get a type of Addison's disease from stopping steroids too quickly. If you start steroids on a long time and then you stop giving them, your body doesn't immediately start producing them again. And
right.
basically, you can send yourself into a little Addisonian crisis. It's more of the prednisolone part of it, or prednisone part of it, not necessarily the mineralocorticoids, but you still will feel weak and still have a lot of the signs and symptoms that you will see with Addison's disease.
Well, and that's actually a really good point, because that is a thing, like, I remember way back, this is when I still lived in Ohio, it was a long, long time ago, but we had a patient that their dog had allergies and they were being treated with Pred, which is, you know, not necessarily the best treatment, but this was a long time ago and it was the best thing we had then.
Mm-hmm.
And the client told me, he was like, well, you know, I've been told to keep him on it every other day, but it's more like it works better for me financially to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, you can't just change that. It's because of stuff like this. If you
right.
just cold turkey quit a steroid without doing that stair step method, you can do something like this.
Right. And it can be what we call iatrogenic, or caused by us,
right.
Form of Addison's disease.
Yep. Okay. Well, that is actually a very good thing to end on. We sort of teased the fact that we're going to talk about Cushing's disease next. And so thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Lovelace.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Again, this podcast is intended for educational purposes only, and it is specifically intended for clients of the Animal Hospital of North Asheville. If today's episode has contradicted information given to you by your veterinarian, please adhere to your practice's advice and policies. This brings us to the end of the episode. If you aren't already, we'd love it if you'd stay connected with us on social media. Thank you for listening, and until next time, may your life be full of puppy love and kitten kisses.